So Psalm 59. My introduction comment is enemies, check the psalm to see if this is true when you read it, but enemies are like wild dogs and are prowling through the city, and the city is plunged in darkness. That emerges from the text. And the psalmist pleads with Yahweh. Yahweh always means, doesn't it? When you think Yahweh, you must think Exodus, Moses, burning bush, journey to the promised land. That's always the big picture into which the word Yahweh emerges. So it's God as God has acted in history and been experienced in the life of this people. So it's a very personal, interactive word. Well, the psalmist pleads with Yahweh to rise and show that he is the God of Israel and won't allow the enemies of Israel to triumph. Let's look at the text to prevail. Verse 1, rescue me from my enemies, O my God. Protect me from those who rise up against me. Rescue me from those who work evil, from the bloodthirsty, save me. They are ruthless. Even now they're out to take my life, stirring up strife against me. For no transgression or sin of mine, Yahweh, for no guilt of mine, they hasten and make ready. Okay, just watch it carefully because it's so normal in the Old Testament. You can see that is worked on a certain assumption. If I had sinned, then I would understand that you would be punishing me through my enemies. You see, that's the kind of complete logic of it. Because if I'm suffering, then the presumption is I've sinned. The man born blind in John chapter 9, we had it yesterday in the gospel reading. Did he sin or did his parents, for him to have been born blind? So there's just this constant assumption that God is controlling everything. So everything that happens, God must will. So there must be a reason for it. God doesn't act arbitrarily. So the reason is sin, for God to punish. Making sense to you? It's not the Christian perspective, but that's their perspective. So here this becomes a problem for him. I'm suffering, but look, it's not that I haven't sinned. This is the book of Job all the way through. This is the philosophy struggling, the later philosophy, when they became more aware of things, more developed the culture, they started to question some of these assumptions, but they didn't quite know how to get out of them. And we didn't know how to get out of them till Jesus. And we saw Jesus getting crucified, who was totally innocent. So that blasts out of the water any connection between suffering and sin. There's just no possibility with Jesus. So that should have shattered that thought. And it did in the New Testament. And then, of course, it sneaks back. So in the culture, the German culture and the Roman culture, as they became Christianized, like all of us, when you're Christianized, it starts pretty well on the surface, I think. And it mightn't penetrate too far. If it gets right in, well, you end up being a saint. But not a lot of us do that. So the culture eventually takes over and reimposes on the insights of Christianity the cultural expectations of the Irish people or the African tribes or the people from Yugoslavia or whoever it might be. You follow my logic, don't you? So that's what's happening here. For no transgression or sin of mine, Yahweh, for no guilt of mine, they hasten and make ready. Rouse yourself to my call. Come and see. And he's quite confident if God sees what's happening, God will do something about it. For you, Yahweh, God of hosts, we've done this in an earlier psalm, I'll repeat it again, I don't expect you to remember everything, and you mightn't have always been here when we did it. Hosts is sabaot. Sabaot means a military, an army ready for battle. Sabaot in the sabaot is a plural. So it's actually looking at the stars. Because don't forget, they thought the stars were living. They didn't think of them the way I think of them, as some kind of, whatever they are, gas or, you know. They thought they were living, and the most pure living creatures, because they were fire. Earth, air, fire and water. Fire was the most pure of the elements. These are pure fire, so they're highly spiritual beings with no earth, air or water in them. So pure fire, and that's got a lot to do with the idea of angels too. So they get quite confused and mixed up in, is that the right word? They think of the two together almost. So the hosts of heaven and the angelic hosts, sometimes they blend into one. So you remember in the story of Jesus' birth even, which of course uses the literature and the language, different insights of course, but still, what do you use? You use your Shakespeare if you're English, you still use those. So they have the idea of when Jesus was born, remember the angel of the Lord? Well, that's God of course, the angel of Yahweh is God, as God appears. But then all the heavenly hosts started to dance and sing with joy, Hosanna, didn't they? Well, that's the stars. That's, you go back now to, I don't know what happened at Fatima, I don't have to know, because private revelation stuff, but, you know, when, remember the people saw all the stars and the sun dancing, wasn't it, in the sky? So God knows what was going on there, psychologically. I presume it's a kind of a psychic contagion thing. Everyone sees it and everyone sees it and expects to see it. Or the island they had for a while, there are these moving statues and things. And some people are very, well, I don't know what they are. They're less sceptical than I am, I guess. That would be a nice way to put it. And they kind of more open. So if something thinks something happened, they all go. And they all think it's, you know, whatever. I'm assuming the statues didn't move, and I'm also assuming it at Fatima that the sun didn't dance, because if the sun danced, I think the world would have come to an end pretty rapidly. In reality, I mean. Okay. All that out of one little verse, sorry. Yahweh, God of hosts, God of the armies of heaven. I could have called, said Jesus, and my Father would have sent legions of angels to, you know, John's Gospel. Don't presume Jesus said that, or if he said it, don't presume he meant it literally, for heaven's sake. You're all right on that, aren't you now? He's talking... Think of Shakespeare before you read the Gospels, and then you're getting the idea. Yahweh, God of hosts, the God of Israel, awake, punish the nations, spare none of them who treacherously plot evil. Then comes a little... There's two refrains on this page. They occur later in the Psalms. That's why you know they're refrains. They turn up at dusk, howling like wild dogs and prowling about the city. And you can imagine if you were Tchaikovsky or something and everything's been in a major chord, suddenly you throw yourself into E-sharp minor and the music... You know, catches you. So the music on the harp would have gone into a different mode. And then there's a pause and they, you know, got it? They get the feel of it. They are like, back to the major chord now, that thunders in from the left of the stage. They are snarling, their mouths filled with daggers. They think, who will hear us? But you laugh at them, Yahweh. You hold the nations. Nations always means the people who are not us. Not Israelites, Gentiles, non-Jews. You hold the nations in disdain. And then comes another refrain. Oh, my strength, I watch for you. For you, O God, are my fortress, my God, who shows me kindness. Kindness is chesed, steadfast love, translated a lot of ways. I keep translating it by the most simple meaning of it. You show me kindness. You want what is good for me. Verse 11, or the second part of verse 10 rather, God goes before me and shows me the defeat of my enemies. Do not kill them. Not if it means that my people will forget them. He doesn't want them to be killed or everyone will forget. He wants them to suffer a very slow death so that people will watch it happening and think, yeah, see, and the next generation. So it's not a very nice attitude, but it's a very reasonable one, and I'm sure if I was in that position, that'd be what you'd want. And whenever anyone is opposing you, you might what to take means of getting rid of them, but if you heard they run over by a bus, you'd probably be relieved, you know. Now, I might be the only one who thinks like that, but it's likely that, you know, that, yeah. There are some people we would be well rid of. That's the way we think. And we're probably not wrong. Don't kill them. Not if it means that my people will forget them. Use your power to make them totter and bring them down. Yahweh, our shield. The sin of their mouths is the loquacious nonsense that they utter. Let them stay trapped in their insolence by the lies and the curses that they utter. Annihilate them in your wrath. Annihilate them that they may be no more, and that they may know that God rules in Jacob and to the utmost ends of the earth. Not difficult, is it, to imagine you're dealing with the time perhaps of the Assyrian invasion or the Babylonian invasion or the Egyptian. I mean, they're a little corridor. They're always being attacked by somebody. So it's a time of foreign occupation and mayhem and brutality and so on. So, and here's this refrain again. They turn up at dusk, howling like wild dogs and prowling about the city. Oh! And then you get into your minor key again and you get in the mood of it. They roam about in search of food and growl if they don't get their fill. And the food, of course, is the bodies of the kids and the wives and the husbands and the people that are being slaughtered. Go to Baghdad today and I think you could read this easily. I will sing of your might in the morning. I will acclaim your kindness. Why in the morning I will acclaim your kindness? Because the morning was always the time of the trial before the city gate. In other words, it means when you vindicate the good and declare judgment. We've got another way of saying that, on the last day, which is even a sillier image than theirs. I mean, the last day, God knows what we could possibly mean by that. It might have a meaning, I don't know. I presume it's the moment of our death for each of us. That'd be our last day. But, you know, we've got to use images because we don't know what we're talking about. We're struggling to go beyond what we can comprehend. Well, their way of saying, whenever they say in the morning, means when you declare judgment, I will be shown to be innocent and they will be shown to be guilty. Now, it mightn't happen till the resurrection. It mightn't happen till, brackets, the last day. But that's it. For you have been a fortress for me and a refuge in the day of my distress. And the psalm ends with the second refrain with a slight change, which is quite lovely. Earlier, back in verse 9, it said, O my strength, I watch for you, for you, O God, are my fortress, my God who shows me kindness. Now, at the conclusion of the prayer, and that's what prayer is often about, prayer brings us to the place we'd like to be. Like we're struggling, we know the direction we should be moving in. Jesus at the agony knew what was asked of him was to do his Father's will. But you don't always get to that in a minute. And the purpose of the prayer is to take you to there, to bring you to there, just like the purpose of the sacrament of reconciliation is to bring us to a perfect contrition, a real repentance, though we know it and we come ready, but the sacrament actually blesses that journey and takes us to the fullness of it. We're hungry, so we come to Mass on Sunday. It's in the communion that the hunger is fulfilled. So here we have again, the prayer brings in, it doesn't say now, O my strength, I watch for you. He was watching back in verse 9. Now in verse 17, O my strength, I will sing praises to you. He's come to a point of confidence that his prayer is being heard and that in a way that's beyond him, he will be vindicated and the enemies will be crushed.